Buena.
Welcome back to Film Posers for Boricuas ranting, raving, and reviewing cinema. Today, we'll be talking about First Reformed for another film breakdown, and our moderator will be Ana Sofia. Take it away.
So, First Reformed, or as Gary likes to call it, First Reformed.
There's a story behind it, I swear.
It is an American drama film by Paul Schrader. And if you guys don't know him, he actually wrote Taxi Driver and he wrote The Last Temptation of Christ and another Scorsese film, which was Raging Bull. So First Reform is about a pastor of a small church that starts partying under control after a soul-shaking encounter with an unstable environmental activist and his pregnant wife. So, me being resident of the Ethan Hawke Stan Club, it was my obligation that I needed to watch this film. And I'm just going to say thank you, Gabriela.
You're welcome. Anna and I watched this film together. I actually watched it, like the year after it came out. And I loved it. And, you know, Anna being, you know, a fellow Ethan Hawke stan, as she mentioned, I was shocked that she had never seen First Reform. I kept saying, Anna, you need to watch First Reform. Like, come on. What are you doing? Until finally, she did. We watched it together and I caught and her reaction to that film was priceless, especially the ending. It was priceless. And I'm so glad that we experienced it together. Well, me for the second time and you for the first time.
I'm really glad too. And I just want to formally apologize for not seeing the movie sooner. So as I said, the movie stars Ethan Hawke and Amanda Seyfried. So to start off, in the first act of the film, we see the character that is already having an internal conflict of him, and he is slowly losing his faith. But it wasn't until he met Amanda Seyfried's husband, which, side note, he's the environmentalist in the film, where he expresses how he just doesn't want his child to live in a world that's basically dying. So in that scene, Ernest, which is Ethan Hawke's character, basically has a cathartic moment, and throughout the whole film we start to see a battle between hope and despair. To start off, what are your thoughts about the film handling this theme? Gabriela.
So to me, I really love films that comment on religion. It's something that I enjoy, and you know how they criticize it and all of that. So from early on, I was aware that this film was a commentary on religion, but I was not aware that it was also going to be, you know, about environmentalism. So when it got to that part of this guy, of the Amanda Seyfried's husband, I forgot his name, that he was going on about, oh, like, it's not even worth it to have children because by 2050, like, we're all gonna be screwed over due to the effects of climate change. And he just went on with all of this about climate change. And I was like, damn, we're really going there, aren't we? So, you know, it made me anxious because, you know, the topic of climate change is one that makes me very anxious. But I really liked how it was handled on the film, and it was handled from the point of view of something, of someone that belongs, because climate change does not tend to be a conversation in religion. It tends to be a conversation in science. And, you know, due to that whole thing that many religious people don't trust science, like not all of them, but, you know, there's a number of them that don't trust science because obviously they believe that God created everything and, you know, that. So I really love seeing it from the perspective of someone who, from a pastor, because then he realizes that he belongs to a church, because his church, First Reformed, this is certainly not a DiCaprio meme, belongs to a mega church, and that mega church receives money from a corporation that is contaminating for monetary gain.
And so he feels bad because he's technically indirectly contributing to the the destruction of the world. And I really like that, how he didn't know what to do, because it was obviously, and his faith was what had saved him after he lost his son and his wife left him. So, you know, being a pastor at First Reform was all he had, that brought him peace. So him realizing that his salvation, quote unquote, was also the culprit in, you know, ending and harming so many lives. It was very interesting to me, because then, you know, seeing him talk to the pastor from the megachurch, which was Cedric the Entertainer, hi, Cedric the Entertainer, I did not expect you to see you there, but hi. And that he was so nonchalant about it. He was like, you know, that's what we gotta do. So, God is good, everything's gonna be fine, like, God will help us. And he's like, but no, we gotta do something about it ourselves. Like, we can't just rely on God for everything. We have to also do the work ourselves. It was very interesting and kind of like, you know, it was something I had not seen before, and it was handled really, really well. And yeah, it gave me an existential crisis. It was great. Exactly what I signed up for. I think it was a very good mix of both things in terms of environmentalism and, you know, speaking the facts, because it wasn't as if the activist was saying lies. He was, you know, saying the truth. Like, hey, we need to work to save the planet, or, you know, our children and the future generations are not going to survive in this planet due to the hostile, you know, environment that it's going to become.
Yeah, and like in that scene specifically, when Ernest sits down with Amanda's ideal husband, he being a pastor and being from the church, he's supposed to be like, he resembles hope, you know, faith can equal hope. So him sitting down, this definitely is a battle between hope versus despair, because climate change and all the negativity he was talking about, but thinking about it, yeah, it's real. Like, when he said that, yeah, the world is going to despair, like, why would I have a child that he's just going to die either way? But thinking about it, I really like how Anna Seinfeld was also the character of hope, because her, like, bringing a child to this world, she said, no, but, like, bringing a child, it is hope to this world, like, the little hope that it has left. So I thought it was a really interesting combination that the movie did. Okay, so Josie, what are your thoughts about the themes that the movie brought out?
So one thing that I noticed rather quickly was the amount of names that were used for the characters that were linked to religion. Like, there were a couple, there wasn't just one, if I'm not mistaken. His son was named Joseph, and then there was another character named Joseph, then there was Mary, and there was another character named Maria. There was also a Jose, there was a Michael, so these are biblical names, which I thought that was a really nice detail to add to a film that deals with religion. Yeah, when it comes to this film, everything, like, I'm not going to be a broken record, everything that Gabriella said is pretty accurate. And I also liked the criticism of how a church usually stands for quote-unquote salvation, but then the film slowly reveals to you that this mega church is taking funds from basically the downfall of Earth and the future of all the people. So I really like that detail. And I just really, so it is a slow burn, but I think in my review I wrote something along the lines of, like, this is an intense slow burn, because the buildup is even paced. It will be slow for some people, but for this kind of story, I think it was appropriate, because it usually goes at a rather slow pace, but then there are moments where it's kind of like an orchestra. There's peace, and then suddenly there's a lot of noise, and it's a cacophony of moments, because the first example that comes to my mind is, he's having these meetings with Mary and Michael, and then he has to go meet with Michael at the park, and then he finds his body on the ground. That's very sudden. So that is the best example for the kind of pacing that you find with this
film. So yeah, and to add up with your comment about the big church, if you see the movie, it also sells false hope to the people that go to the church.
Yeah, that's like the comment it has on mega churches, because that is the main criticism of mega churches. They are more focused on making money than, you know, spreading the faith. I really like that about that film as well. You know, that's, you know, mega, there are so many mega churches that exist, you know, Joel Osteen being one of the big figures of a mega church. And, you know, there's another one in California that's pretty well known. And yeah, that was the main criticism of, you know, those people just want money. They don't care about, you know, doing good or, you know, preaching what the Bible says.
Yeah, and so that was a very interesting detail was the fact that when they got to the reconsecration, take a shot watching this film, the amount of times that they say reconsecration. So when they finally get to the ceremony, that you see these people getting out of these expensive cars with bodyguards and everything, and you're like, aren't you supposed to be humble people of the church that serve the people, like, so the film is very subtle with its criticism, but the message gets across pretty accurately. And another thing that I wanted to touch upon was something that Gabriela mentioned, which was, again, the whole point of the film is hope versus despair. And it's very interesting how the film ends on both notes equally.
Yeah, and I also like how the character, like, progresses, because in the first, like in the first act, he's writing this journal for 12 months and he's trying to be hopeful, but you can see that in some shots the papers are like torn up. It's because he doesn't want to be like deep in despair. That's why he just tears it down. He doesn't want to accept like kind of his reality or the reality that he's living in, because he meets Amanda Seyfried's husband, which is the environmentalist, and he gets just a hit that, yeah, I am working with this church that is ruining basically the environment and is bringing despair to the world.
Yeah, I mean, he's sick himself, which I think is also a parallel to what Michael is criticizing.
So what are your thoughts on the themes of the film?
I feel like everything been said is very accurate with the film. I saw it for the first time before this recording today. So I feel what this film does is it makes it for the audience who maybe doesn't like a slow burn, like myself. Like Jolie said, the pacing did not work for me. But it makes it feel, with every topic discussed, very real. And one of the scenes that, thinking back on it, when it was mentioned here about how it was trying to convince everyone else, there's a scene where they try to convince the children about the church as well, and that's very prevalent in today's society. When they're at the church and they're showing the kids around, that's very prevalent in today's society, what I've seen, because they do try to convince the kids to join the church, see the goodness, see the hope, and it very much shows the impact that churches overall, like Gabriela said, whether it's large or small, try to have on society overall. And they present themselves as humble. And then when you see the end of consecration, you see that Michael ended up having a point about, look at the greed that you're not even seeing. And to a point, even Michael had some points. And Michael's character, I feel, was supposed to be the shock for all of us, because he's there trying to spit all the facts towards the audience. And then when you see what happens, when you see what happens after he passes, you're kind of just there like, holy shit, we should have listened. Yeah, I think it handled the topics in a very different way. I wasn't expecting him to handle it. I think overall it's very real. in its impact and the way Paul Schrader wrote this was he wanted, from my perspective, he wanted to leave you with that impact of this may be fiction, but now start questioning everything and you might see some of the cracks that I showed here. So it was very interesting.
Bringing back the topic that he is losing his faith, and you see Amanda Seyfried's husband, he, from the beginning until the end, he, in a sense, he was faithful to his cause. So I feel that also was a cathartic moment with the character.
You know, I think that, you know, Ernst didn't have that much faith from the very beginning. I think he became a pastor because he had nothing else to do. There was nothing else left for him. And, you know, in a moment of great vulnerability, you know, he had lost his son. That is, you know, an unimaginable pain. And he was very vulnerable. So, you know, he is approached by this priest and he's like, hey, why don't you become part of us? You know, you'll have a community. God will help you. You know, all of that. So I don't think he, because obviously he was married before, he had a children. You know, most of the people that end up becoming priests have that calling from early on in their lives. So, I mean, I don't know how that works. So I could be wrong. The very beginning, it gave me a feeling that he was not really, you know, being a priest was not his calling. Like, that was not his purpose in life. He just went into it because he had nothing else. And a very vulnerable moment in his life led him to that position. So him losing his faith, yeah, it was bound to happen, because, you know, if you're not really into it, you're eventually, it's gonna run out and you're not going to be happy.
So I actually wanted to propose a question to the group, because at least for me watching the film, after a certain point, I was pretty sure how the film was going to end with Ethan Hawke's character. You could tell that his mind was made up and that he most likely was going to try to end his life the same way that Michael did. But when exactly do you think he makes that decision?
It's a really hard question.
It's a little bit hard, but I think he decided when he realized the church was, like, buddies with the corporation that was, like, ruining the environment. Yeah, he was like, this is the church that I follow, like, and that's where he, like the small faith he had left, it was gone.
Yeah, there are moments where when they're talking about the reconsecration and they're like, are you sure? Like, yes, but he says it with this such a determination that I'm like, okay, you have something planned, especially when he tells Mary not to go. So it could be after he does that research.
But also, I think what also cemented his decision, because he was thinking about it, you know, dying for the call like Michael had. But I think the moment that he decided, you know what, this is what I'm going to do, was actually when it was confirmed that he was sick. Because at that point, it's like, I'm going to die anyways. I have nothing to lose. Might as well die for a cause.
No, okay. I had, at least I was under the impression that he knew he was sick all along.
I think he suspected it, but, you know, I don't think it's the same, you know, you suspecting that there's something wrong with you, then going to the doctor and the doctor plain on tell you you're right, you're sick. Mm-hmm. So I think it was that moment of him, like, being told point blank, yes, you're sick, that basically confirmed, know, that decision.
Yeah, it's the exactly. I was under the impression that he always knew, but that could be that makes more sense.
I mean, I may not be a doctor or anything, but in the movie, he literally pees and it's red.
Yeah.
So I literally would have been like, I'm gonna go check that out. So that's when I'm like, he knew he was sick. But for me, when he started doubting himself, I saw it when he found Michael's body, because he started asking himself, so what were your last words when you die? Like, oh, mm-hmm. There goes my head. Like, the thought gets into his brain at that moment. But for me, he toys with the idea when he finds the research And the idea is confirmed when after he has the conversation with Cedric the Entertainer's character in the office, and the door is closed, and before it was open, and he starts asking about his health, and they're worried about him. And because I think he put on the vest to go somewhere else exploring just to see what it would feel like on, to see if he actually could wear it. So I think after that conversation is when he was like confirmed, that's when I know. But the thought was implemented when he felt he failed to save Michael, because then that's a failure on his part, because he's like, I was supposed to convince him to stay, to convince him to be a parent, to help Mary, to save him. And he kind of felt like he failed. And even then the scene where they're talking in the like a cafeteria, they asked him like, so you were one of the last people to talk to him and try to help him. And they try to make it seem like, yeah, they at least, not from my perspective, I felt he did his best. But they tried to make it be like, well, you were the last one that tried to help him. Maybe it's on you. And I think that's when you start to deal with your inner saboteur of like, well, maybe I could have done better. Maybe I'm not meant for this. Maybe the church isn't right. And all these questions start to pile in. So that's when I felt he started like major doubt.
Yeah. I also feel that going like back to what's point of like him feeling guilty that he was the cause of Michael's death, quote unquote, is because he also was the one that convinced his son to join the military. And months later, he died. So he already had that guilt with him. So when Michael died, his guilt obviously, like, was worse.
He felt as if everywhere he went, death followed. You know, because, you know, all of these bad stuff kept happening. And, yeah, you kind of start getting a little weirded out when everywhere that you go, bad stuff happens. So that definitely could have influenced him as well. Which is ironic
because his character is supposed to represent salvation for everyone. So the fact that, like you said, death kept following him is kind of like, well, maybe it's me. Like, maybe I'm not cut out for this.
Yeah, and he also, like, I think there was a conversation between the pastor that the pastor said, hey, why is it that you're always, like, tombs, like, around tombstones all the time? Like it's not good for you. He always wanted to be surrounded by death, in a sense, because that also reminds him, like, the thing that he did with his son. Like, it was his fault, quote-unquote, that his son died. This is going rather deep, guys. This is a rather serious episode. So, First Reform is also a very spiritual film, but what makes it stand out, it also intertwines with environmentalism, especially, yes, I'm going to that scene where Amanda Seyfried and Ethan Hawke just, like, are in the living room and they're basically levitating and going on a trance. What is your interpretation on Desi? Because for me, it was just like blatantly there. Okay, yes, look what we have done to the environment. This is all we have done. We should do something about this. So to start off, Gabriela, because I see you like,
I love this film. I love, you know, talking about it. But if there's one thing that I still don't have an answer for, it is that scene. There's so many things to unpack from it, because, you know, you could be like, oh, maybe because he clearly liked her, he liked Mary, and it could be, you know, that she came over and they wanted to establish an emotional connection. But he can't because he's thinking about all the death and destruction that the church has caused and that he needs to do something about it. And so that's why at first when the trance starts, you see, you know, at first, like, you know, green scenery and all of these beautiful landscapes, and then it turns, you know, horrible. It's because that's what he was thinking. Oh, how wonderful that Mary is here and that I can, you know, be with her and talk to her. But then he remembers, like, oh God, this is what's actually happening. Like, the planet is dying. I have to do something about it. Like, Michael died for this. I have to carry on his legacy. I must do something. So I don't know. That's how I see it, but it could be so many other things. It could be, you know, just like, yeah, trans. I don't know. I really don't know. That's just like the whole emotional thing. That was my first thought when I saw it for the first time. It's kind of like what I keep thinking it is.
I agree with you, but it also made me thought about how, like, this character is battling between hope and despair. So there was a moment of hope, but he suddenly remembered what, like, the amount of despair that he had and the burden that he had, that he couldn't leave just a little space for hope.
Exactly. That's how it is. It started as something, you know, lovely, that, you know, she was coming to see him, that he could tell that she trusted him and all of that. But then it's like, yeah, I can't be happy when all of this is going on.
So, Josie, what are your thoughts on that scene?
It is literally a religious experience.
Well, you're not wrong.
Yeah. It's just, it was one of those moments where either we could see it as an intervention of the divine within that scene, or the way that I processed it was a moment where he had this non-sexual intimacy with Mary, and at first you start seeing all the good in the world, but then his mind is clouded by all his anxieties. So I felt that was a visual manifestation of his mentality and, like, the downfall of who he was as a person, and again, his mental health.
I agree. I just miss this scene. Like how they say here, estaban tripeando en coitre. Both of them.
Oh my god. I really like the scene because it also reminded me of a scene that's in Kajillionaire. That if anyone listening, if you haven't seen it, I highly recommend it. And it also goes into this moment where all you see is stars and the night sky. Mm-hmm. And it starts talking about existentialism and the meaning of life. So I definitely felt those vibes, because again, I saw First Reformed recently for this episode, and I saw Kajillionaire first. So I already had the influence of Kajillionaire in my mind. The only thing is that Kajillionaire, while it does talk about existentialism and the meaning of life and how wasting your life can be daunting in those final moments, with First Reformed, it felt like the opposite, because with Kajillionaire, it leads to this evangelical seal of appreciation for life, while First Reformed just goes into further despair in that moment, which is supposed to be like this wonderful moment, because the reason that she used to do it with her husband was to feel peace and connection, and he did feel that connection, but he also felt not only connection with Mary but with his inner demons.
I love how you just talked about Kajillionaire.
Thank you. I love the movie.
I know.
So what are your thoughts of that scene?
I had so many questions when I first saw it. My first question was, am I high? My follow-up question, am I not high, but they were when they made it? And then my other question was, like, is this where Dua Lipa got the idea for the levitating music video? Because that would make sense. Listen, she levitates, they levitate. It makes sense.
I love it. It's the series episode one was like, nope, I got a reference.
Can't do that.
I gotta spice it up.
I have to reference pop culture.
Like, we're missing some sabor. Honestly, though, when I think about it, if I were to, like, deeply analyze this in a philosophical type of way, Ethan Hawke's character, or as I feel Gabriela might start calling him, Ethan Hunk.
Oh my god!
What?
We'll talk about the whole thirst reform thing
later. Yeah, yeah. So I feel that in the movie, Ethan Hawke's character was literally like, my marriage failed. My son died. He felt he was broken. Mary's husband literally killed himself, shot himself in the head. Head exploded in the woods on the snow. She's obviously broken. Both of them lack intimacy, lack like this deep connection that they used to have. Both of them are broken pieces trying to find their way to mend themselves back together. And in that one moment, the broken pieces find their way back, because it doesn't have to be necessarily sexual or anything. If anything, it's two broken people trying to mend each other the only ways they know how. And with the levitating, it's just like their auras are kind of like aligning, because they're in that same state of mind. They're in that same state emotionally because of what's happened to them. And yeah, it's different. And Mary didn't always acknowledge, like, yeah, she was always like, yeah, I'm okay. Like, I'm trying my best. She never really acknowledged that vulnerable side of, like, of course I'm fucking ruined. My husband just shot himself in the head with no, like, previous connections of what it could be like, of, like, what it could have led to. So that scene, I feel, is just representation of, like, if I were to combine it, my definition with Josie's of divine intervention, because it's kind of like, these two can found each other, they can help each other, and for that one moment, you're kind of like, they could really help each other out. Then the rest of the movie happens.
So after hearing Juan, now I want to throw another question to you guys. Why do you think that Ethan Hawke didn't choose to stay? Because he had an emotional connection with Amanda Seyfried's character. And he could easily be like living with her happily. But why is it that he just didn't choose? He just went on with his plan.
Because he was going to die. He was sick.
I mean, he did went to the doctor, and he couldn't choose, because he chose to ignore him being treated.
Exactly. He didn't want, he apparently gave, you know, he allegedly made people think that he was not going to receive treatment, because apparently, you know, it was going to be way too advanced and too late for treatment. So he was going to die. So he was not, why stay with someone who already lost her husband and have her lose someone else too? That's not, he wouldn't want to do that to her.
I also found it so selfish, because at that point, because she already lost someone, and clearly she's formed an attachment to him, mm-hmm. because they have bonded throughout this tragedy. And then he was also going to follow in the same steps of her late husband.
True. Like,
hasn't she suffered enough?
True.
I think, on top of that, I think she said she was moving. And he said, oh yeah, you can totally come visit me. And that, after that connection that they had in the levitating scene, I feel that was his last straw of, like, hope that he could latch on to, that if anything, he had any doubts, any things, like he wanted to talk to someone, feel a sense of normalcy, the only person he felt he could trust was her, and she was moving away. Because he couldn't trust anyone in that church, really. He didn't find one person that he could have confided in, because or else he would have. And after he discovered everything that was going on within his own church, the last sense of faith and hope he had left, he's kind of like, well, I'm losing Amanda Seyfried's character. The church doesn't back me up anymore and is not what I believe in. And like Gabriela said, he thought he was dying. I believe when he lost everything, he's like, there's no use, because he doesn't think he's going to make it past what the doctors are going to tell him. And he was also afraid to hear officially what it was. He had an idea. That's why he kept drinking his sorrows away. So he knew he might not have made that. So he just said, you know what? There's nothing left for me to live through. But I agree with Josie. It does feel kind of selfish that you put Amanda Seyfried's character, who tried to help you, go through that. And when he sees her arrive in that last 10, 15 minutes at the huge event thing, I forgot the name again, but the huge event thing, you're kind of like, well, You would have think that would have been enough for him to be like, let me change my mind. Because she came back even though I told her not to.
Yeah, because what he decided to do is basically because what he didn't want to harm himself. He wanted to harm everybody else and then take himself with them. But seeing her there, he didn't want to harm her. So, of course, he did something that would cause self-inflicting pain and ultimately possibly ending his life. And now we'd like to take a moment to talk to you about our sponsor, Anchor, the easiest way to make a podcast. And we're back. Thank you for listening to our sponsor, Anchor. And now we'll continue with the First Reformed breakdown.
So I know that we already went on a tangent and on a ramble talking about First Reformed, but let's talk about the acting. So what do you guys thought about Ethan Hawke and Amanda Seyfried's like acting in this film? Now, to start off, Gabriella, what are your thoughts?
I mean, you know, Ethan Hawke can do no wrong. He's a great actor. And Anna can vouch for me on this. She's the fellow Ethan Hawke stan.
As a fellow member of the Ethan Hawke club, I can vouch what Gabriela said.
Yeah, I thought he was great. And, you know, it was a shame that this film wasn't recognized as much. You know, it was nominated for Best Original Screenplay at the Oscars, but it was nominated, his performance wasn't recognized in the Independent Film Awards. But, you know, I do consider it to be one of his best performances. And yes, I thought he did great. And that goes into why I call this film Thirst Reformed. It was this running joke. Every time I talk about this film, I say Thirst Reformed. And none of the posers understood why until Anna watched it with me. And she understood what I meant.
I understood and I agreed with Gabriela.
You know, that shirt was a little tight on him.
Him being a pastor, but I was like, that's a little tight, bro.
He's like, bro, you're a pastor, but that look looks so good on you. Like, look at that fit right there. You look so good, man. What the heck?
I literally said fit check.
Fit check. So, yes, it's this running gen. That's why I call it Thirst Reform, because Ethan Hawke look kind of hot as a priest. Like, let's just be honest here.
So is it safe to say that the Thirst Reformed is just never quenched?
Oh my gosh.
Anyways, great performance by Ethan Hawke. I thought he was great. As for Amanda Seyfried, you know, she's really not in that film as much. You know, she has like a few scenes, and she did mention in one of the interviews that she filmed for like a week. She had wrapped her scenes, and you know, she did good. She's a really good actress, and her performance is very subtle. I like to say it's very subtle because she's kind of like an ethereal presence in the film, if you will. She's kind of like an angel of hope for Ernst. But I think she did a great job. I honestly can't name a bad actor in the entire cast. I thought the entire cast did a great job. So yeah, can't complain about the acting, really.
I'm sorry, I'm trying not to like compose myself after Gabriela's ramble about Thirst Reformed. I'm blushing a little bit, not gonna lie.
But it's funny.
So I thought his performance was really great, and to go with Amanda Seyfried, like, yes, she is an ethereal like presence, but I think she really stands out at the end of the film.
Again, I really can't complain about any actor in this film. I thought they all
did. And I wish people like give more praise to Ethan Hawke in this performance, because
thank you. That's what I've been saying.
When we talk about Ethan Hawke, people talk about, I know this is like a little bit condescending, but the Before trilogy, okay?
Of course you can bring it up.
But he is a really good actor. He has like he has done a lot of performances that are also great, that doesn't have to be in the Before trilogy only.
But the performance is really good. Top tier.
It is. I think, Gariela, if you leave me, I can go to a ramble, but this is an episode of First Reformed. So to continue, Josie, what are your thoughts on the performances?
So I'll actually keep it brief. I liked everyone's performance. I think everyone they did what they had to do. And Ethan Hawke's performance was really good, especially considering how he contributes a lot to the stillness of the film, and I thought he embodied it so accurately. But then he also has contrasting moments where he's so vivid and like he takes up more space than he usually does during the rest of the film. So again, those contrasts and that dissonance throughout the film, I contributed a lot to him and his performance. I don't think the film would have been the same without him. And well, I love Amanda Seyfried's character because I believe her to be the embodiment of hope. I could definitely, like, again, it was very believable being able to see her in different scenes, actually being able to bring Reverend Toller back from his despair at times.
So lastly, Juan, what are your thoughts on the performances?
I agree with Josie. I thought Ethan Hawke was great. I thought Amanda Seyfried was, basically she was the reason getting me through the film because, again, not into Snow Prince, not into religious films, but Amanda Seyfried was there, and I was like, okay, she's doing great. Again, like Josie said, everyone did what they had to do. Everyone delivered. And, yeah, I definitely think this is probably Ethan Hawke's... I can't speak that much about his entire filmography, but this is definitely the one performance that I feel will last the most with audiences in terms of impact of what he does as an actor, but also what his character does.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah, I agree with all of you. Lastly, to end this episode. So a lot of people are in the fence with the ending, and I want to hear your theories of did he die or he didn't die. So Gabriela, she has a big theory, a spicy theory.
It's very
What do you think?
He died. And let me tell you why.
Gabrielle is currently drinking water because Thirst Reformed was too much.
So, he died. And let me tell you why. So, you know, the scene where everyone is arriving at the church and, you know, the priest from the mega church asks, you know, where Ethan Hawke is, and, you know, he's in his office, you know, he has the vest on, he like pours the drain cleaner, and then he does like the barbed wire thing. So he goes to check on him, and there is an emphasis that the door to Ernst's office is locked. The priest cannot open it. And then all of a sudden, Amanda Seyfried walks into the room. When there had been an emphasis that the door was locked, how did she get in? So it is clearly a vision that he is having because he has died. You know, maybe from the drain cleaner or, you know, from one of the things that he did, he clearly died from it. And he sees Amanda Seyfried, you know, on the other side, and or sees, you know, like the last thing that you see before you die. Some of it, but clearly Amanda Seyfried walking into the room was a vision that he had. She really was not there. And that is my theory. He is dead. Rest in peace, Ernst.
So, when I first saw the film, what did I just watch?
Her reaction is so hilarious. I'm so glad I have it on video for him.
I actually thought he didn't die. But Gabriela was like, Sweetie, sit down. And when she told me that, like, the door and how, like, the door was locked and how can it be, like, all of a sudden her character, like, comes and marched in, I was like, okay, I see it. And then I start to realize the camera movement also emphasizes the dreamlike state because mm-hmm. throughout the whole film, it's, like, very still, very slow. And this is the first time that we see a lot of movement to like the film and like a very hopeful thing in a sense, mm-hmm. because it's two characters like connecting. Because we saw, we saw that scene of like we're elevating, but this is the first time that they were truly like together. So yes, I do think that because he died and what we saw was like the imagination or the last thing that he wanted like to happen before he died. So Josie, give us your spicy take.
What is your spicy take, Josie?
Or he didn't die.
Hello, it is I, the person that always loves to contradict Gabriela.
That's what our entire friendship is based on, you contradicting me. I love
You've heard it here first, the Vivitch controversy. Now we're going into First Reformed ending, and I have receipts. So I'm going to quote from Film Colossus, where they try to explain the ending of First Reformed, and it goes like this. Funny enough, director Paul Schrader was asked by Sofia Coppola about what the ending means on the A24 podcast, to which he responded, "I don't know what the ending is." It can be read in either one of two ways. One, that a miracle has occurred and his life is spared. The other is equally, in my sense, optimistic, which is that he drinks the Drano and he is on all fours. He's throwing up his stomach and God comes over to him, who has not talked to him for the whole movie, and says, "Reverend Toller, you want to know what heaven looks like? Here it is. This is exactly what it looks like. It looks like one long kiss." And that's the last thing he sees. So it could be both. I personally would like to believe that he lives, but the question is like whether he makes it to the hospital in time or not, because of course he has very serious injuries. But I do think that is, because this entire film is supposed to be about hope, whether we want to believe it or not. And I do believe that the ending suits it if it's supposed to be about that message, because Amanda Seyfried's character is basically a guardian angel throughout the entire film, being able to try to save others from their despair, and she's not able to do it throughout the film until that very moment. So I'd like to believe that he does in fact live, and that is my spicy take.
I just teared up a bit. Honestly, when you said heaven is like a long big kiss, I was like,
ma'am?
Introducing the sequel to the Before trilogy.
Yeah, those are Schrader's words.
Damn, Schrader. Damn.
Yeah, so I'd like to believe that, like, listen, if he leaves it open for interpretation, then let it be open to interpretation. And I'd like to choose hope. I think this film is meant to be like a glass half empty, half full kind of scenario. So I am hopeful. You guys are in despair.
I am a cynic. I can't help
it. I'm an optimist.
Yeah, we can tell by the type of ending you choose to believe happened.
Juan, take us home.
Oh boy.
What is your spicy take?
Oh boy, that ending. Well, let me start by saying that the ending was very off-putting for me. To the point where, like, I was there going like, okay, this is interesting. And then I got to the end and I'm like, oh, why do I have a sour taste in my mouth? Oof. So, by the way, I saw this on Showtime. If anyone wants to watch this film, you can see it on the Showtime app. When it comes to Ethan Hawke's character, I'm torn, because on the one hand, Barbara, he drank Drano, he's probably dead, and he has stomach problems. To say that we know of. It's the only thing we know. He might have stomach problems, or he might have cancer. They never really made that clear, because he never went to a doctor. And while on the one side, I'm here going, maybe he lives, and Amanda Seyfried and him, you know, end up happily ever after, and they, like, end up together. The kiss, for me, if it's, like, him and Amanda Seyfried ending up together, I kind of feel like that ruins the moment of the levitating scene where it's like two people who just need to want to help each other do it in a way that it's not romantic. And then the kiss is like, oh, it's romance now. And it's like, well, then what was the point of levitating? You know, I do want to be optimistic that he makes it and he like just gets a second chance. But I just have the feeling that, like, you know, when I see the barbed wire going, I was like, nope, 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 get that off my screen. I can't. Like, it's really a far way to go. So that's when I knew he was like done. Because with the minute you put barbed wire around yourself, like a like covering your body, I'm like, nope. Oh god, I'm even sick talking about it. Sorry. Point is, it is unfortunate what happens to this character. I do know there's two ways to see it. And though, by the way, Josie, kudos on bringing Sofia Coppola into this to making Gabriella even more salty about it.
Yes, because she asked him the question. I'm like, Sofia Coppola, asking the right questions.
We are all Sofia Coppola.
I think it just ends up becoming a matter of, do you want to believe there's hope after everything he discovered? Or do you want to believe, like, you can either be an optimist or a pessimist, or do you want to believe that this is how we're all going to end up because the world's going to go to shit?
Yeah, because then what does that say about us?
Exactly. Realistically speaking, based on what he decides to do, it doesn't look good for him from a medical standpoint. Mm-hmm. But if we're looking at, like, a Hallmark situation, he lives. So I'm going to actually root that he gets a second chance. I'm going to agree with Josie. I'm going to hope that he gets a second chance to, like, solve everything in his life and take care of himself because he wants to do better.
I love how we're both tied here, that Anna and I are both like, he dead, and you and Josie and Juan are like, nah, he lives, you know, let's have some hope here.
Well, that's the thing, I'm like 50-50.
Yeah.
Which is my state of mind. I can either be an optimist or a pessimist. But in this case, just so I could feel a little bit better about the movie, I want to choose the optimist side. And I want, because I do feel bad for his character. After everything he discovers, everything he goes through, he ends like that. Like, that's not a way, that's not the way it should be. But then it also proves Michael's a little more valid in a way.
Yeah.
Which is so sad, because there should be hope.
Yeah, I thought I was going to be alone on this matter. So I'm glad I have a
sorpresa.
I have a little bit of support. I mean, definitely a question to pose to those listening to this. We'll probably either tweet about it or make a poll. And please let us know what you thought, because I think it's definitely open up to interpretation. And the very director said so. And open endings are fun in that sense, so we definitely love to hear your input, but you know what we think. So will we judge you? I don't know.
Also refreshing to have a 50-50 split here.
Yes, just remember there are no right answers.
Even the director said so. There, it can go either way.
So watch Thirst Reformed and form your own opinion about the ending. And what do you think of the ending? Are you, who do you agree with? Did he die or he didn't? Are you, you know, in despair or hope? What side of the aisle are you on?
Was that a church pun?
Yes.
And you can go check out A24's Existential Crisis of a Film, First Reformed, on the Showtime app. If you have the Spotify Premium for students, you get that in your package with Hulu and Showtime for $4.99. No, this is not an ad, but I'm willing to do so if that's what it takes. So check it out. Or you can rent it if it's available. All up to you.
Also, like, if we're going to talk about Hot Priest, you know, is it Ethan Hawke or is it the Hot Priest from Fleabag?
I think this is another discussion.
I think that's a Clubhouse meeting waiting to happen.
That's all for today's episode. We'd like to thank you for listening and to give a shout out to all the kind people sending love our way. If you'd like to keep up with us, make sure to follow us at Film Posers on Twitter, Instagram, YouTube, and TikTok. Also, please make sure to check out our social medias during this week because we will be covering Sundance. So definitely check out especially our Twitter, our Instagram, and our YouTube channel for current reviews,
on the fly. Now, where can they find you, posers?
So you can find me over at Twitter at Gabby_Burgos27, over at Instagram at GabbyCristina27, and on Letterboxd at GabbyCristina.
So you can find me on Instagram and on Twitter with @_Sophia53 and on Letterboxd @_Sophia.
You can find me on Twitter at @LeaderOfMohicas. You can find me on Letterboxd for some spicy takes at Leading Mohicans. And you can find me on my blog, Reinvention of a Lost Writer, on WordPress.
And you can find me as @TheJosieMarie on basically everywhere. Again, thank you for listening. And remember, we're all film posers. Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.